Welcome back to Radio EcoShock and Earthbeat. This week we are talking with off-grid specialists about your future with renewable energy. Our first guest, Cam Mather, was already a publisher when his family set off for an off-grid home in the wilderness. Most of us won't be leaving the city anytime soon. Let's see what energy solutions we can use right now. We go to the UK for our second interview with Nick Rosen, the author of How to Live Off-Grid, now updated with the new American version. Has anybody noticed energy costs going higher and higher? Yes. And you ain't seen nothing yet. Our wallets are just beginning to compete with all the rising industry and Western-style living, cars and consumerism in China, India, and beyond, all while fossil fuels get dirtier along with the air and the weather. A lot of us are dreaming of unplugging from the matrix, but we want to have some lights and maybe the telephone, too. That means getting off the grid, but making our own power. I'm Alex Smith. Back in 2008, we interviewed one of the field leaders, Nick Rosen, author of the UK book How to Live Off-Grid. Last year, he came out with the American version, Off the Grid, Inside the Movement for More Space, Less Government, and True Independence in Modern America. Nick Rosen, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be back.
Well, Nick, you started out as kind of a niche leader in a way, and now that seems to have morphed into a busy movement. How do we define off-grid today?
Well, the technically, straightforward definition is living in a situation without any utilities, generating your own power, dealing with your own water, whether it's rainwater or from a spring or a river, and dealing with your own waste, both your organic waste and your trash, maybe even using your waste to create energy, which is the really cleverest way to do it. But yeah, so that's the kind of straightforward definition of living off the grid, is not being dependent on any of those grids of power and water. But there's also a more metaphorical definition, which is about independence from the system, a kind of sense of self-sufficiency, which a lot of people are seeking now because they've lost faith in the system. They don't think the system, whatever you define it, is going to look after them, is going to deliver the things that we've traditionally expected from society, a welfare net, some law and order, a continuous supply of energy. These things seem to be breaking down around us.
When we chatted on the phone the other day, you listed off five reasons why people want to take control of their own power needs and their own lifestyles, and I seem to fit in every category. Please explain those different ways people come to this desire to unplug.
They're probably more than five. But reason number one for a lot of people right now is just plain money and the lack of it. People are having their homes foreclosed, they're losing their jobs, or they're afraid of having their homes foreclosed and losing their jobs. And that single thing is probably the biggest motivator to think about living off the grid, because of the security it gives you, the feeling that nobody can take that away from you. If you live off the grid, your bills are low to non-existent, other than possibly small property taxes, which are obviously going to be less than your mainstream properties. So money is probably reason number one. The environment was always a motivating factor. It was what got me interested in the subject, but that's no longer the prime motivator. So number two is wanting to live a cleaner lifestyle, wanting to do less damage to the earth, wanting to be one of the advance guard, one of the environmental foot soldiers who leads by example. And then the other reasons are different but related. So there are some who are just straightforward survivalists. They've just completely lost faith in the system. They are highly suspicious. They feel that all government is a conspiracy against the people, and they just want to turn their back on society. Yet another reason is just a kind of weariness with consumerism. I mean, we've had 50 years of joyful consumption, where Americans and British and Europeans, we've all overhoused ourselves. We've all greedily opted for larger and larger homes, which we've stuffed full of more and more possessions. And now we're suddenly looking around us and thinking, do we really need three televisions, eight pairs of pants, countless radios and electronic equipment? Whatever happened to the idea of simplicity? You know, is simplicity just something you do for a week, once a year when you go on vacation? There's a lot of people who are kind of slightly disgusted by the consumer society and see going off the grid as the ultimate antidote.
And I guess I'd toss in peak oil there, too. There's people who feel, well, there just won't be the energy anyway.
Absolutely. That was what I was coming on to next, was oil and food, because, of course, they're closely related, which is that food wouldn't exist without the energy to farm it and distribute it and freeze it and heat it. And so as this idea that oil production has reached a peak just at the time when demand is going through the roof because of the newly emerging BRICS economies, people are looking around saying, well, this doesn't add up. You know, it's a bit of a miracle. We haven't had that many power cuts yet, but they've got to be coming, more so in Britain, with the rules of health and safety in power stations, with the nuclear frights that we've had in Japan. There's every chance that we're going to see power shortages and power rationing sometime in the next decade. Couple that with food shortages, with the very sharp food price rises we're seeing, the good people who, for all the right reasons, advocated biofuels only a few years ago, and now sheepishly admitting that actually that means less room on the planet for growing food, and another reason why food prices have gone up, and obviously food prices going up is the equivalent of food shortage. I mean, it's about the laws of supply and demand. Although actually, I should say, coupled with a lot of hedging and speculation in food, because just like the banking rules were relaxed, the rules were relaxed to allow people like Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan and so forth to buy food that didn't exist, to buy wheat and grain and commodities that didn't exist. There used to be a limit. You could only buy physical commodities for delivery. But once those rules were relaxed and people were able to start speculating wildly in commodities, that was what led to some of the sharp rises that we've seen. That's right. Peak oil and food. And complete the picture of what is driving people to think about living off-grid. And there is one other kind of, those are all rather negative, but there's one very positive factor as well, which is the technology is enabling it. It's just getting easier and more comfortable and cheaper and more practical and a more obvious choice as time goes by.
I think we're kind of hung in a balance. As long as we've got a job and things are okay and we can buy berries at the supermarket flown in from Chile, we'll keep doing it. But we have in the back of our minds we'll go off-grid sometime a little later. But if hyperinflation strikes or banks go bankrupt or we just get sick of it, as you say, does the ability to go off-grid depend on being at a certain point with some money and some control over your life? If you leave it too long, is it going to be harder to do?
I think it'd be very hard to do when everybody else is doing it. That would be, you know, really the wrong time to try. It's not very financially dependent, actually. You can go off the grid with very little money or with a lot of money. You can do it in a way to preserve your existing Western lifestyle, or you can slash your consumption by 90% and still live a very good life off the grid. So, no, it's not something which requires a vast amount of money, but it does require a change of mindset. More than it requires money, you've just got to re-examine the way that you burn energy, the way that you waste food. I think that all of us who are lucky enough to have money in our pockets, we eat too much, you know, and not that we're obese, but, you know, we eat more than we need to, and we throw away food that we've over-purchased from the supermarkets. And we leave lights on. I'm not suggesting we should feel guilty about that. Quite the opposite. It's actually quite a liberating thought that you could halve your food and energy consumption and actually hardly notice it, simply by only eating, you know, what you need and only burning lights when you needed them and turning the thermostat down and all those things. So for most of us who still got jobs, it's reassuring to think that we could halve our consumption without suffering at all.
Nick, if we halved our energy consumption and our imprint on the planet, we'd have to descend to the lifestyles of people in countries like Sweden or something. I mean, that would be terrible, as we know. Look, I just watched a YouTube video on how to make your own solar panel with stuff from the hardware store, and there's homemade water heaters with black pipe that seem fairly easy to make. I've seen a homemade wind machine even. Are you hearing much about do-it-yourself energy tech?
Yeah, a lot. There's in fact, on the off-grid website, the stories that get the most reader reaction are the ones which are kind of low-tech solutions to modern living. So it's stuff like the washing machine made out of a bucket and a plunger. People love those stories. I'm about to do a story about a wind turbine made out of an old bicycle wheel and the forks from a bicycle, producing just on its own enough, easily enough, for a couple of lights. People dream about living this simpler life, but as you say, we're not doing it. I do hope that it doesn't need some sort of crisis to make it happen, because people could actually see it as a way of liberating themselves from the repetitive cycle of working, commuting, to pay the mortgage. Although, of course, work provides satisfaction and status and self-respect, I think a lot of people would like to work less. You know, if their bills were lower, then rather than having more savings, they'd probably prefer to spend more time on leisure pursuits.
Well, hold on to that thought. This is Radio EcoShock here with our friend Nick Rosen, author of Off the Grid, Inside the Movement for More Space, Less Government, and True Independence in Modern America. You know, your book title, Less Government and True Independence, sounds a bit libertarian, almost something the Tea Party might say. How does getting off the grid change our politics?
Yeah, it's funny that, but, you know, I think there is a common cause between the libertarian left and the libertarian right, between those who feel that we've become too harnessed by corporate America on the left and the right. So I'm not ashamed of the kind of libertarian nature of that title, but it does belie my approach, my personal approach, which is to do with lower consumption and to do with getting away from consumerism. Whereas I think the Tea Party is more about releasing money so that we can all choose what we spend it on. My approach is more to do with reducing the amount of resources that we need to live a happy life.
There's another aspect to it. I mean, you got me thinking with the title and with the book about just the freedom from regulators setting rates, the centralized control that you have to have, well, the military that you need just to have a nuclear plant. The oil and coal lobby always lying to us. If you've got your own solar panels or you've got your geothermal heat, you're out of that. You're out of that need for a big centralized controlling government to authorize your life.
Absolutely. And it also means that you're also free from having to think about them and argue against them and observe the way that they are inverting so many values. In the book, I spend a whole chapter talking about the growth of the grid, the way that the grid was created by the electricity companies to suit themselves rather than to suit the consumer. Even the pricing mechanism, which is that you're charged per unit of electricity, wasn't something that was brought in right at the beginning. At first, Edison used to charge people by the number of lights they had in their homes or offices. But he quickly realized that he could make much more money by charging for a unit of electricity and making sure that the lights use as much electricity as possible. So right from the very beginning, the energy industry has been slanted towards maximizing the consumption of energy. You can almost say that's a tautology, and nothing wrong with that. But it's led us to where we are today, with people's energy bills ratcheting up alarmingly to the point where perhaps 10-15% of the population of North America is what you might call energy poor, which means that they're spending, you know, a large proportion of their disposable income just on heating and cooling. Meanwhile, of course, the energy companies are precisely the people who promoted all of these consumer gadgets that I was talking about earlier, that people are now sort of faintly embarrassed about how many of these things we have. But the whole idea of the consumption of power was promoted by the energy companies. And I documented all really carefully in the book through secretive PR campaigns where they encouraged people to buy more and more gadgets. And they hired, it was GE actually who kind of led all this campaign and who invented, you know, great advertising phrases like make your house a home. There are dozens of examples in the book of how they arranged for textbooks to be slanted so that they encourage people to buy more appliances. Yeah, it was a classic case of manipulation of public opinion. There were all sorts of specialist committees set up, like the NELA, whose job was to spend millions of dollars a year right through the 1920s on scholarships, on organized letter-writing campaigns. For example, in Illinois, this organization sent a press release to 900 newspapers once a month, offering speakers to encourage people to use more electricity. It was done as a sort of great campaign to civilize America. but it was really just a sales campaign. It was dressed up as a liberating experience, but it was just about selling power.
Well, now to save the climate and to save the last of the oil and to save ourselves, we need just the opposite. We need letters to the editor every month from somebody, and we need speakers to go out there to tell people to stop using so darn much electricity and energy.
Yeah, but we're not getting it. You know what we're getting? We're getting something called the smart grid, which is a way of cementing this completely inappropriate energy system even more firmly into place. We're now being told we've got to spend a couple of trillion dollars in North America on the so-called smart grid, which is going to harness renewable energy that we perhaps even produce in our homes, send it back onto the grid, and do it in a kind of massive way that will allow us to go on using energy at precisely the same rate that we're doing at the moment, and which we strongly believe we should not be doing. So the so-called smart grid is a huge conspiracy being foisted on us by the industry. Unfortunately, with the connivance of the government, public money currently being spent putting smart meters into homes all across America, these so-called smart meters, which have only just been invented and engineered, are not even ready for the marketplace yet. We'll probably be changing them all in 10 years' time. They're probably not interoperable. In other words, when competitors come along wanting to offer a different kind of electricity tariff, they'll probably find they can't use the smart meters. These smart meters, by the way, signal back your energy usage back to base, so the energy companies now can get rid of their meter readers, which alone would save them enough money that they should have been installing the meters for free instead of charging us. I'm getting letters from all over the country and all over the world talking about what's happened to people's energy bills once the smart meters have come in and how they've increased. And the ultimate plan is to start charging for energy in the same way that you charge for cheap airline tickets, putting the price up when the demand is at its highest. And that is a very antisocial move, because who's going to decide that some elderly woman in Texas has suddenly got to pay more for her air conditioning just when it's the hottest part of the day? It's going to be an executive at GE.
Or her oxygen supply. Look, as we head towards the end of the interview, I'm wondering, could you just describe one off-grid home that you have visited?
There are so many. If I may, I'll describe two. I want to describe one, which is a really makeshift home. A woman who was a nurse in Schenectady, and she didn't lose her job, but her hours were shortened suddenly. And as a result, she couldn't pay her mortgage, and so her home was foreclosed. And this woman with three kids was homeless. This woman who'd dedicated all her life to service, aged about 35, just had her last $25,000. So she bought some land in Texas near the Mexican border. She bought a trailer, and she drove down to this piece of land and set up a new life, and it's working for her. She doesn't owe anything to anybody. She works in a nearby bar. She's growing some food on her land, and she's just living in this trailer, and it's a perfectly comfortable life. She's part of a community of about 300 or 400 other houses around there, people living in the same way. It's not a commune. They all own their own land. They all have their own energy arrangements. But they're a community who help each other with advice, and they can do a bit of group buying to bring down prices. So that's perhaps a surprising example of someone living off the grid. And then for a more stereotypical example, perhaps we could move to New Mexico, where there are hundreds and thousands of these so-called earth ships, which are buildings made from old tires, which have been rammed full of earth and held together with a bit of lime. These are a way of using waste resources that would otherwise just clutter up the environment. And because of the huge thickness of the walls, they're never very hot and they're never very cool. They're always roughly the right temperature. It's a movement in New Mexico, which is very interesting to watch. People arriving, some with plenty of money, but some with no money, building themselves a home and starting a new kind of life, free of mortgages and bills and the need to work 5 days a week or more just to pay that mortgage.
Our guest is Nick Rosen, the off-grid living expert. Nick, tell us about your website and any new projects or articles that you're working on.
Sure. Well, the website is just there to kind of act as a center for the off-grid community so that people can discuss common issues, perhaps get together to buy solar panels at a discount, talk about low technology solutions of the sort I've already mentioned. We've also got a little free service called LandBuddy, because the thing about the off-grid community, although it's growing very fast, it's still very scattered. So you could be living in the same town as a lot of people who want to go off the grid, but you'd never know who they were as you walk down the street. So LandBuddy is one of those Google map mashups. You can go on and you can browse the map and see where people who want to live off-grid are. And you can post your own entry and make a little dot on the map where you are or where you want to be. And then you can get together with other people who are also in the same area, and you can buy land together, or you can discuss how you're going to set up your off-grid homes together. And there are three categories. There's people who want to live off-grid, and then there's people who are already off-grid who are looking for others to join them. And then there's people who are just interested and want to get to know more about this. So we're finding LandBuddy is growing very, very fast. And my next project is to make a documentary series about off-grid living, looking at the technology and the reasons why people are doing it, to kind of connect, so it's not just a kind of techie study, but it connects the social issues with the technological issues and shows that you can live off the grid in comfort and dignity without actually being an engineering graduate. You can do it very easily.
I want to see that film when you make it. What is the website, please?
Just offgrid.com.
There you go. You've been listening to Nick Rosen, author of Off the Grid, Inside the Movement for More Space, Less Government, and True Independence in Modern America. He's a key figure in the off-grid movement in the UK and Europe as well, and now he's been traveling around quite a bit in North America. If you want to get unplugged and make your own, start with the website offgrid.net or offgrid.com. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I really appreciate your coming on the show with us today.
It's a pleasure as always, and it's great to see your show developing and growing the way it is.
Please find all our interviews as free MP3 downloads at the website ecoshock.org. Just look in our program archives or in the audio on demand menu. Point your friends to our show blog at ecoshock.info with the program player right on the page. Or download it to pass around to help your friends and neighbors. Next week, we leave solutions behind for a minute to catch up on the latest reports with climate science. No matter what your economy felt like, the world set a new record for carbon emissions in 2010, where filling the sky, we went over 30 gigatons. At that pace, we are headed toward an unimaginable climate disaster. A huge shift, not seen for more than 100 million years, is headed our way. Many species will not survive. Humans may go extinct. But hey, anything for another $1 billion and dirty profits, another mansion in soon-to-be-flooded Florida or the French Riviera? Here's a clip from Noam Chomsky. I'm sorry, the original YouTube compilation was not dated or sourced, but this is a very recent talk.
You mentioned global warming. See, it's very interesting the way that's portrayed in the media. It's portrayed as if there's two sides. You know, we have to be objective, so 50% for each. One side is like 99% of scientists. The other side is Rush Limbaugh, Sarah Palin, Jim Inhofe, and three guys that they kind of contrarians in the science community. So we give them equal time, and then how's the ordinary citizen going to figure it out? Actually, the New York Times had a front page story a couple days ago about the very interesting controversy that's taking place between climate scientists and what they call meteorologists, the people who appear on television to tell you whether it's going to rain tomorrow. And they differ. So how's the ordinary citizen going to figure it out? First of all, it should be pointed out that there's actually three sides. There's not two. There's the mainstream scientific consensus, and there's two groups that of denialists. One of them is the one that's given equal time, Senator Inhofe, Rush Limbaugh. But there's another one, which is very significant. Major groups of scientists who think that the mainstream analyses are nowhere near grave enough. This is very serious work. I mean, MIT just came out with a big study, their scientists, saying the reality is far worse than what's predicted. Well, they're not part of the debate. So what's the ordinary citizen going to do? Well, he's not going to become a climate scientist. But, the choices in this case are so transparent. that it doesn't take a lot of work to figure it out. I mean, what's the chances that the overwhelming majority of climate scientists from all over the place, either the ones who say it's very grave or the others who say it's even worse than you claim, what are the probability that they're wrong and Rush Limbaugh's right? I mean, it's not a hard decision. You don't have to be an expert. And there's another point to be made about all of this. If you try to think through the cost-benefit analysis, suppose the people who deny it are correct and you do something about it. Okay, you've spent some money doing things you probably should have done anyway, like more renewable energy and so on. But the total cost has cost you something. Suppose, on the other hand, that the consensus is right. Well, if you don't do anything, human species is probably down the drain. Okay, those are the costs you have to estimate. That's not particularly subtle.
Now let's hear from Bill McKibben, the first author to write a book about global warming. It was 1989, titled The End of Nature. 22 years later, despite organizing climate awareness actions around the world through 350.org, Bill McKibben admits it is already too late to stop the climate shift. All we can do now is limit the damage to help our descendants avoid the worst.
Now it's too late to prevent really massive change, but not too late to prevent the worst kind of tipping points. I mean, we've already increased moisture in the atmosphere about 5%, the ocean's about 30% more acidic. We're seeing deluge and flood in kind of unprecedented ways. These are very dangerous, powerful things that we're not going to be able to push back into the closet. But everything's relative, and it can get a lot worse than that if we don't wise up pretty soon. We haven't done all that good a job of organizing people who, I think that environmentalists have counted on the fact that they were right to do the work for them. We had for 20 years the kind of superstructure of a movement. We had scientists and policy people and engineers and things. We just never had any movement. That was the part we left out, And that's what we've been trying to build at 350.org with some success over the last year, both here and around the world.
Will the recent storms and strange weather around the world wake us up? Next week, we'll examine reports from Australia, from the International Energy Agency. We'll try to capture some of the wave of recent climate science. And we'll join Greenpeace in the Arctic for the next big oil move to pump more carbon into the sky. The Arctic, it turns out, contains itself a giant carbon warehouse. What happens there may determine the history of all living things. Support the return of Earthbeat by going to earthbeatradio.org. I'm Alex Smith. Start your summer listening with our past Radio EcoShock programs as free MP3 downloads at ecoshock.org. Fill up a CD or your iPod, take it in, and then pass it on. Take what you know, and please act. Thank you for listening. And thank you for caring about our world.